Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, September 15th. This week, we'll be taking a closer look at our judiciary system. Drug court is marking 3 decades this year, and we plan to take a look at other specialty courts that have been created to give people a second chance at life on the straight and narrow. We get to know a Maui artist and the stories behind her designs that she calls Love Letters to Lahaina. Plus, we hear about a new art exhibit that shines a light on Hawaii's connection to abstract expressionism. And we strum along with a recent Punahou graduate and Harvard freshman who showcased her musical skills on NPR's From the Top. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Back in 1995, Hawaii lawmakers took a chance on something called drug court to deal with the rising cases of crime around drug abuse. Under the late Chief Justice Ronald Moon, the idea was born to find a better way to deal with those convicted of drug crimes and to reduce recidivism. It was a joint effort along with law enforcement and prosecutors. 30 years later, with the data to show its success, there have been spinoffs. There is now a veterans court and mental health court, which sprang out of the desire to do better than just lock people up. Matt Viola is the first circuit court judge in charge of Oahu Drug Court. And Greg Uwono is the administrator for the specialty courts. We talked with the two of them last week about the programs that are in place to deal with the substance abuse issues that are often the underlying reasons why people end up behind bars in the first place. Judge Viola starts us up.
If you address those issues, people will commit less crimes and the community will be safer. And over the last 30 years, we're coming up on our 30th anniversary in Hawaii, in the First Circuit at least, with our drug court. And I think over time, that initial idea has proven to be true.
I understand there's something called juvenile drug court as well?
We do. In our family court, we have a juvenile drug court that has been in existence for over 20 years. I happen to have been the presiding judge for that court for a number of years before I became the presiding judge of the drug court in the First Circuit on the adult side. So the approaches are similar, that is to address the underlying causes of their involvement in the system. The dynamics are a little bit different because they are children, of course, and developmentally they respond in different ways to different kinds of treatment or system approaches. Their families are involved a little more heavily, but same basic idea.
What has been the most gratifying thing for you as you look back at how this was first started and created and the good that it's done?
Oh, I think far and above the most gratifying thing is to see people who succeed in overcoming their great challenges. You know, a lot of our participants have lost some degree of hope. They've created lots of problems for themselves and the people they care about. And with a lot of hard work and interventions and treatment, they start to turn their lives around so that they end up becoming not just law-abiding citizens or net contributors to our system rather than being net takers, but they heal. They heal relationships with their family, and they're good, productive, law-abiding citizens. We see that very frequently. Not everybody succeeds in these programs. We have a pretty good success rate. Over time, we've graduated probably about 1,200 to 1,300 participants in the drug court program. And ripple effects of that success are enormous. So that's the most gratifying thing, to see individuals succeed and turn their lives around.
You talk about hope, and I remember when Judge started that, the Hope Probation, holding out that light, look, we can do this, we can help you turn your life around and set you on the right path.
What I've come to learn is a lot of the participants in these programs, they're labeled as failures, criminals, drug addicts, and honestly, in the beginning, sometimes those labels are apt. A lot of times the participants see themselves that way, but that's not necessarily who they really are. So over time, they they start to shed those labels and they become who they're really meant to be. And that's good for all of us. That's good for our community. It saves us a lot of money. And again, the focus is on really it's a public safety program, ultimately.
And Greg, I know as a courts administrator, you're juggling a lot of moving parts. What is it that you see with drug court, the value of that?
I see a lot of the connections, reconnections with the community, with their family, all the things that Judge Viola was speaking about, and just seeing them in the community later thanking us and seeing that they're working and getting back in their lives and having just a life again. Those are the things that makes it worth for us to continue going.
You know, as we mark the 30th year, I just think, you know, all the people that have worked on this, Chief Justice Moon, Judge Dukayona, right? All the folks that have played a part in building this program over the many decades.
Yeah, really. I think the heart and soul of the program is not just the judges who are the presiding judges or C.J. Moon, who was the Chief Justice at the time the drug court started. They are, of course, critical. It's really the people who do the work on our programs day in and day out, particularly our probation officers, our treatment counselors that we have in drug court, the case managers who work in our mental health court, and our veterans treatment court, which of course focuses on individuals around the criminal justice system who have served our country. We have veteran mentors. Those are typically retired military people who know what our veterans have been through and can guide them through this process. So it's all those people, I think, who deserve the most credit for the success of our programs. We have some really good partners, too, in the community with mental health court. We work closely with the Department of Health Adult Mental Health Division. And like I said, in Veterans Treatment Corps, we have our mentors, but we also work closely with our Veterans Administration. And in Drug Corps, we have a lot of treatment providers who do really fabulous work for our participants.
And Greg, is there anything you want to add about those courts, Veterans Court? It sounds like it's almost like a Wounded Warrior project, right? And there are folks that have been there out in the foxholes, if you will, and know the trauma and know how hard it can be to process that when you come back into regular life, civilian life. And, you know, and then same with the mental health issues. We're seeing so much of that out on the street.
Just to mirror what Judge Viola was saying, and we do have support from Veterans Affairs, the VA, and they've been really supportive, providing a lot of support with providing them with different resources in the community. A lot of the mentors that come back are alumni from the Veterans Treatment Court also, and they also help. So they are a big support for all of this too.
Well, as we think back about the first 30 years of drug court and then with the emergence of these other specialty courts, what's on tap for the future? I mean, where would you like to see some of these programs go? Are there plans in the works now to grow them?
I think we're always looking to grow our programs because I think there are a lot of people who can be served by our programs. We have to do that in a smart and incremental way, and these programs do cost some money, so we have to take that into account. I think one of the issues that we've been focusing on, but we know that many of the people in the criminal justice system, but particularly in our courts, have suffered from some form of trauma in their lives, and that does explain a lot of their behaviors, a lot of the reasons why they've entered into the criminal justice system and need help. So we are trying to focus on building out our trauma responses so that we can, again, address the underlying issues that cause this person to be in this situation in the first place, and then to help them so that when they leave our programs, they will continue to succeed. So I think that's one of our current initiatives, and I think that'll be true across, that the issue of trauma is true across the board in all of the specialty or treatment courts. We know generally probably about 80% of people in our courts have some form of trauma, often dating back to their childhood. And when that is unaddressed, it leads to worse outcomes. They focused on improving our responses and helping our participants address their underlying trauma issues.
Yeah, you want to get to the root of the problem so we just Absolutely. Don't have these repeat offenders coming up, you know, before you on the bench. And Right. you often hear advocates say, you know, we shouldn't be building more prisons. We should be creating more treatment programs and we shouldn't have to send our inmates off to the mainland. But sometimes the programs that they offer there in some of those prisons, they're things that we don't offer here.
That's true. I think there are certain individuals who, for a variety of reasons, end up being sent to prison. The treatment programs we have here, although we could use more, because there are wait lists for a number of the programs, we have some very good treatment programs here. But really, one of the biggest benefits of our specialty courts is it's expensive to house somebody in jail and prison. And to the extent that we can keep them in the community and keep them in the community safely, it saves. It's a very cost-effective way to do business in the criminal justice system.
Yes, you know, I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that we need, that you want the listeners to understand about these specialty courts.
You know, one thing I don't know if this is a widespread perception, but you know, there's some people who may think that this is, some of these individuals really should go to jail and go to prison. And there are certainly people, again, who don't succeed in our programs and end up going to jail and prison. But these are not easy programs for someone to participate in. We demand a lot, and a lot of what we demand are some sort of, I guess you would call them old-fashioned values. For our participants, they need to be honest. They need to, if they can work, they need to be gainfully employed. We impose curfews. We make them live in clean and sober houses or living situations. We compel them to participate in their treatment, and not just participate in the treatment, but to succeed in their treatment. We require them to pay off their financial obligations, such as fees, fines, and restitution. These are difficult programs. It is not unusual for new participants who come in to say, this was much harder than I thought. So they are rigorous programs, and our focus is to make sure that they, as long as they're living out in the community, that they're living out in the community safely. And if they're not, there will be consequences. We do hold our participants accountable in a lot of ways, including that they can be sent to jail for violations. And we intensively supervise them. They will come to court in the beginning weekly for weekly court hearings. They will report to their probation officers frequently, including weekly or more often if necessary. They will be drug tested very frequently, random drug testing, and that will take place over the course of their participation in the program at each of these programs dozens and dozens of times. And the same model applies to the Veterans Treatment Court if the participant has a substance abuse issue. And similarly in mental health court, our mental health court participants, one of the requirements is that they have to suffer from a serious and persistent mental illness that was one of the causative factors for them being involved in the system. And those programs are equally rigorous. So I think to the extent that there's a perception that these are programs where people get to live in the community when they shouldn't be there, that's not correct.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners? Any particular case that really spoke to your heart?
One person I was thinking about recently, maybe something of a good example. She was a participant in our mental health court program. Many of our participants, or all of our participants, have to have some serious persistent mental illness. Many of our participants suffer from schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she lived a very, very hard life. Her mental illness caused her to believe that trees were harassing her. So she would walk around the community with a bicycle helmet to protect herself. She lived on the streets primarily. She was victimized regularly. She had a substance abuse issue with methamphetamine, which is still one of the most common substances of abuse. And so she came, and she had previously been in prison, and she came into our program, and slowly but surely with this team approach, she stayed, right? She got into a treatment program, and she actually finished that residential treatment program. She started getting the right kind of medications, and she took them regularly. Then when she transitioned out of that residential program, she got into group housing. And she graduated from our program having been clean and sober for over a couple of years. She had stable housing, And to me, that was remarkable, close to a miraculous story, because she was one of those people who was lost. And that turnaround in her life was directly attributable to her participation in mental health court and all the work that the people who work in those in our program did for her. But one of the things that is most gratifying to me is when our participants in any of the courts reconnect with their families. And many of them, because of their criminal history and their substance use or mental illness, have lost connections with their families. And over time, when they turn their lives around, they start to heal those relationships. And I think that is one of the most meaningful things that our participants experience. And for me, it's the, one of the most gratifying and meaningful things that I can be involved in.
That was First Circuit Judge Matt Viola and Specialty Courts Administrator Greg Uwono highlighting the programs in place to help get to the root problem of why people often end up in criminal court. Tomorrow, we plan to take time to learn about girls' court, and the next day, women's court.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' 15th anniversary celebration, online September 18th to 21st, featuring Kona Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
You can call these interim orders provisional orders, temporary orders, but they have real-world immediate consequences. And I think this could be a new normal. But these days, seemingly half of the Supreme Court's efforts are devoted to this kind of speedy, unexplained work.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Our next segment is about getting to the stories behind the design. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel spent some time getting to know a Maui artist who talks about her work as love letters to Lahaina. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so tell us about this artist.
Yeah, so Courtney Lazo is a Lahaina fire survivor. She's also a Native Hawaiian Filipina, and she started her clothing brand called Henohea. After the wildfires, she lost her fifth generation home in the fire, and she also found out the month of the fires in August 2023 that she was pregnant with her third son after more than a decade of struggling with infertility. And so it was a really, interesting timing for her that she felt was like a new beginning for her. And so her son's name means a beauty that rises from the ashes, and the clothing brand is named after her son. Her clothing, like you said, she describes it as a love letter to Lahaina. You know, it's featuring designs like ulu and flowers from her grandmother's garden that burned. And Courtney talks about how the inspiration came to her for her first collection.
My first launch that I did was actually based on my grandma's flower in our garden, because I also remember that when we were living in Red Cross, right, temporary housing at the time, and she was like down the hall from me, she would always talk about how she missed her flowers and her plants. So that's kind of another reason why I decided to draw that. Understanding and knowing that And at the time, you know, when they were saying, okay, the cleanup's going to take 3 to 5 years, building in maybe 5 to 7 years. And just looking at her age, I was like, man, we don't know if she has this time. You know, I was just like, how do we preserve these memories, or how can I preserve these memories for her in a meaningful way? And that became my first part of my first collection and my first launch of Henohea back in November of last year.
Oh, I love that idea.
Yeah, and her most recent collection that was just released online last week is called Halia Aloha. And it's inspired by the plumeria lei that her grandmother and her grandmother's friends used to get together. And so every week they would sit on the lawn in front of the Baldwin home on Front Street. And that was one of her favorite, you know, her grandmother's favorite memories from before the fire. You know, some of her grandmother's friends didn't survive the fire. And so finding a way to honor those traditions that they loved so much and meant so much to so many people, they would sell those lei that they would make in front of Baldwin Home as a fundraiser for the Lahaina Luna High School Scholarship Fund. And so it was a really meaningful thing for them that they did every week. And this collection is a really beautiful, colorful, you know, way to wear those stories. Courtney uses natural plant-based materials in all of her clothing as opposed to synthetics like polyester in her brand. And I thought this was a really interesting part of our conversation. You know, she explained how she had gone through unexplained infertility, like I said, for over, you know, over 10 years. You know, during that time, she and her husband went through a lot of testing and was told everything was normal. But Courtney shares how she found out a chemical commonly found in synthetic fiber is actually linked to infertility.
Then it finally came down to me doing the fertility testing at this last time, and we went, you know, a layer deeper, and they're like, well, you have unusually high levels of formaldehyde in your body. And I was like, what? They're like, yeah, you know, formaldehyde and like nail polish and, you know, nail polish remover, just more of the common stuff. It's in household cleaning products. And at this point, I had already gone like more holistic with household product. I stopped painting my nails years before that. So I was like, all right, where is this coming from? Like, especially for me, I'm such a health nut. Yeah, I found out that it's like a lot of it is in our clothing. And I lived in workout clothing because I worked out almost every single day. And even if I wasn't, I was in leggings and sports bras. And, you know, my bed sheets were polyester cotton and my blanket was a fleece polyester. And then a lot of these materials contain formaldehyde in it.
Wow, that's so fascinating.
So fascinating. And I did some research after talking to her, and yeah, there's a lot of research and studies that have been done linking, you know, formaldehydes, you know, they're a chemical commonly used in manufacturing fabrics, linking those to infertility. So that was really interesting to me. You know, she did get pregnant finally. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, her son was born after the fire. You know, she had a newborn as she was, you know, in a hotel and, you know, went through postpartum, you know, depression as she was struggling through fire recovery. It's hard to imagine. But, you know, that out of all of that was what came these drawings of, you know, her grandmother's garden and the things that started and were really the inspiration behind what became her clothing brand. And so, you know, all of that goes into why it's important to her to use, you know, these natural materials that are in her clothing that she now sells. And so for her, Henohea is really about telling the stories of Lahaina.
The Halia Aloha collection really represents the stories of our kupuna. I feel like we have walking history books that are still with us, and they hold so many stories that should be told. This is just my way of honoring their stories and honoring their memory and honoring the ways that they show up for our community. So to choose the plumeria lei, something that represents a fond memory of theirs, it represents their service to the community, it represents a time in their lives that brought them joy. And for them to see these pieces, as they learn that this piece is about them and it's for them, my hope is that when they get to see these pieces out in the wild, like I like to call it, that they know, like, oh, this is to honor my memory, or this is to honor the work that I do, or this is to honor my friends that we lost in the fire. However they want to interpret it, I just want them to feel, you know, loved and honored, and for this generation that may not get to see Lahaina fully rebuilt, I want them to know that we're going to try and keep the story living on, you know, through us, whether it's through clothing or however. So aside from it just being a beautiful piece and a beautiful collection, for me, it's just making sure that we continue to raise awareness and share the stories of our hometown.
So Catherine, where can we find her, her collection?
Yeah, so she sells online. She has a website, hinohea.com, I believe. But she also sells at local markets and pop-ups. She was on Oahu a couple months ago at Ho'omau, and she travels around, you know, selling her clothing at local events as well. And, you know, she and her family are living, just moved back into Lahaina. They're rebuilding their home. And so, you know, it's all woven together with her story, with Lahaina's story, and, you know, with carrying those memories
forward. Well, thank you so much for highlighting this.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
That was HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwa-Pachtel. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
It's Peter Sagal. We were already excited to come to Honolulu to do two shows at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, but now we're beside ourselves with excitement because on October 9th, we'll be joined by ukulele virtuoso Taimane, and on October 10th, we get to talk to Olympic gold medal surfer Carissa Moore. I just feel sorry for the people who have to decide which one to go to. For tickets, hey, maybe to both, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait.
Sponsored by Hawaii Pacific University and Honolulu Financial Partners.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
An art exhibit around abstract expressionism that we have highlighted here on Hawaii Public Radio has found a new home, a permanent home. Here to talk about that is HPR's arts and culture reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and so the name of this exhibit is Metcalf Chateau. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so Metcalf Chateau actually was, it premiered at the Honolulu Museum of Art back in 2018. This is when our former colleague Noi Tanigawa was here at HPR. And I took her place, mm-hmm. Following up with that story. And now the Metcalf Chateau exhibit is permanently housed at the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Rise Center. And for those who don't know, the Rise Center is kind of this this space at UH Manoa that's part of a learning center and a student dorm.
Yeah, it's right there on the main drag, right?
Yeah, University it's right Avenue across the street from the University of Hawaii and right on Metcalf Street.
Yeah.
Right at that corner is that pink building, actually.
Yeah, brand new.
I know. It's nice inside, too.
It is.
And right when you walk through the doors at the Rise Center, you can actually see the exhibit. There's about a little over a dozen of the artworks from sculptures and paintings. And the one that stood out to me that I recognize his name because we've all seen his piece at the Capitol Rotunda is Tadashi Sato. And Tadashi Sato is actually a part of the original seven artists called Metcalf Chateau. And these seven artists, they all got together. They rented out this dilapidated building at 2022 Metcalf Street, which is just maybe like a block away from the Rise Center, but on the same street. So this exhibit really pays homage to these artists, these seven artists. And what you see in the exhibit is kind of this abstract expressionism. And abstract expressionism emerged in the 1940s, so after World War II. And it was a way for artists to really express themselves in like these bold colors, these paint splashings, the flick of a paintbrush, and the these bold strokes as well. And it depicts on how what the artists are feeling at the time. A lot of artists, especially in New York, who were a part of World War II, they wanted to escape the fear and trauma from that war. And what the Metcalf artists like Tadashi Sato or Edmund Chung, Bompei Okaji, and James Park, for example, some of them actually went to New York and got inspired by this art form and brought it back home to Hawaii. So it was interesting to find out in my reporting that Hawaii has these ties to abstract expressionism. And Walter Dodds Jr. is the funder of the RISE building and a longtime CEO of First Hawaiian Bank. He donated money to the RISE Center, and he also has some of the artworks from the artist in his personal collection.
Some of them were students at the time at the university when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Had difficulties at the time because they were Asian. They had lots of challenges and struggles. In any case, you know the story, they volunteered for the war and became one of Hawaii's, U.S.'s most decorated units, of its size, the most decorated unit in the history of the United States. And they came back after the war, and they wanted to re-assimilate in the community, and they had the GI Bill, which allowed them to get a free education. Business was still kind of shut out to them in those days, so they pursued law, medicine, dentistry, and a small group went into art. Bompei Okaji, whose statue is in front, the sculpture is in front of this building, is the first ever graduate from the University of Hawaii Art School with a master's in fine arts. They got together, the original seven and six later, so there were 13 altogether, got together, and the original seven rented the beat up old building on Metcalf Street, right around the corner, just a block away. And they called it lovingly the Metcalf Chateau. Well, the Metcalf Chateau became quite famous when the Honolulu Academy of Arts asked them to do a show. It became a hit, and it was modernism, island style, kind of created by this original group, and they're the most famous artists that we know of today. So Tadashi Sato, Isami Doi, Bompei Okaji, all of 13 of them, you know, have left their mark on our community.
And I also spoke with Allison Wong, who's a curator of this exhibit. And, you know, she talks about, you know, what these artists have faced in their lifetime and how important their works are to aspiring artists.
Well, their time in New York, so they're working along their contemporaries of the big New York named artists. And they have traveled to New York, but they came back home to make a career of it. And that's a big gamble. So, I mean, at the time, to have works in New York and then come back to Hawaii, but be home with family, be surrounded by your environment and nature. So if you look at their works, you can see Tadashi Sato. Nakalele is one of his favorite, like, fishing holes, you know. So these are the mountain ranges by Satoru Abe. Bompei Okaji's, you know, abstract forms are also made out of copper, but also relevant to our environment and our mountain range. So for them, it's poignant to them and it's personal, but also they are working alongside their peers on the East Coast and certainly being recognized.
And so anyone can just go into the RISE Center and look at these artworks themselves. Personally, my favorite is Jerry Okimoto's chair piece. I actually thought it was a building at first, but it was these exaggerated stretch canvases that people can see for themselves.
Well, they're a very well-known artist, so yeah, I'm sure it'll be impressive. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio talking about a new permanent art exhibit at the University of Hawaii's RISE Center in Manoa.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Mary Cassatt at Work. The Impressionist dared to take the lives of women seriously as subject matter for her art. HonoluluMuseum.org.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by nearly 200 local organizations that make us a part of their communication strategy. Mahalo to Asset Schools, Bank of Hawaii, and Anchor Systems Hawaii. They believe just as you do in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Today, a young musician from Hawaii shared an unusual style of guitar playing with classical music listeners nationwide. College freshman Ash Boo is featured on From the Top, the most popular one-hour classical program on public radio. The show highlights young musicians each week and is broadcast on more than 200 stations nationwide. Take a listen to part of the segment that aired today, featuring Boo's original composition, Moonshine.
Next, we meet 18-year-old guitarist and composer Ash Boo from Honolulu, Hawaii. Ash, welcome to the program.
Hey, glad to be here.
What will you be performing for us today?
So I'm going to play an original composition that I wrote way back in 23, feels like a lifetime ago, called Moonshine.
Great. I'm so excited to hear it. Whenever you're ready, take it from the top.
That was Ash Boo. Taimani Gardner, move over. Boo is a graduate of Punahou and a current freshman at Harvard University studying electrical engineering. Boo spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the experience of being on From the Top and the style of percussive guitar that she has perfected.
Tell me about the first time you ever picked up a guitar. So my mom's a professional classical clarinet player. She's retired now, but she did that as like her main career. And so I wanted something that was as different from the clarinet as possible. And also, like, you know, I was a rebellious little and so, of course, like any like small thing that I can do that like stereotypes me as a gender other than the one that I am is like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And I really wanted to play like a lot of like classic rock songs that my dad liked in the beginning, which was kind of frustrating because my parents put me in classical lessons. But yeah, I didn't really start taking it seriously until much later than that, though.
Okay, so first experience with guitar, kind of family driven. Maybe for our listeners, can you define percussive finger style? So what is that?
Percussive finger style is a relatively new genre of music. I'd say all but one of the kind of defining founders of the genre are still alive, which most music genres cannot say. And it is based around the idea that we are opening up the entire body of the acoustic guitar. And so we are able to use aspects of not just the percussion and not just the strings, but also, for instance, like harmonic sounds, picking on the head of the guitar or adding extensions. I know people that have glued kalimbas onto their guitars and harp guitars and things like this to open the body of the instrument such that we are not focusing on the traditional way that a guitar is played, but rather just creating as many new sounds and new possibilities as possible.
What do you think it is about that style that draws you to it? What do you like about it?
I haven't thought about this very much before, but I have ADHD, and so I stim a lot, like, you know, the shaky hands thing. And something to do with the way a lot of fingerstyle works, the kind of music that I do is very, very percussive in nature and focuses a lot on like building up a beat. It almost makes me more of a drummer than a guitar player. And so it's kind of like a stim in that regard. It's just like something that pervades every aspect of just like the way I interact with the world, and it makes it difficult to get away from. You know, like every teacher I've ever had has like pointed out the fact that I do the like rasgado, which is when you like have many successive percussive hits at once, like on my desk and whatnot. It combines the like methodical motor program training aspect of classical music with this more like creative experimental sound that you can't really get anywhere else, I think.
Tell us a little about how you found training in what seems to be a relatively new field of guitar music. What outlets and what teachers really trained you?
I consider myself to be very lightly a part of a lineage that exists on this island. So my first teacher was Helena Behrens, who is a well-known gig musician around town. And I was with her for about 7 years, and she was really foundational to just like building essential technique things and music theory, but also just like building a kind of like emotional connection to the instrument. And she was really instrumental with that, no pun intended. Helena and I are still great friends. And then when I turned 14, when I went into the academy, when I went to ninth grade at Punahou, I had the opportunity to join Darren Au's classical guitar ensemble. And that was the place where I was really able to find just like a really high level of musicianship. Even if you put like technique and whatnot aside, I think I wasn't playing my most technically complex music in that ensemble. Ensemble musicians rarely are, but it was about building an ability to kind of like think independently while also being part of a larger machine and thinking about the greater good of the music. And that's something really valuable that I took away from Darren's ensemble. Darren was actually Helena's teacher. That's why I refer to it as a lineage. And in addition to that, I also attended this camp for fingerstyle guitar players called the Thomas Lieb Acoustic Boot Camp, which is actually in Austria. It's kind of a funny story how that happened. Like, my stepmom kept telling me to reach out to Thomas Lieb, who is like one of my childhood heroes. Like, oh, you should just like talk to him, shoot him a DM on Instagram. I was like, no, he's too famous. He would never pay attention to me. Fingerstyle guitar players are never too famous. And he didn't just like text me back. He sent like, you know, paragraphs upon paragraphs about this camp and like reassured me with like past stories. He even went through like my previous posts on social media and like asked me about them. It was so sweet. I even like about a year later got to like go meet him at his house in LA, and like I played for his students at Cal Arts. I love Thomas. He's great. Yeah.
Wow. So you attended that camp, but you're also a composer. Maybe it'll be helpful to focus on the piece that you'll be playing on the NPR music program from the top. How did you write Moonshine? And just walk us through the process of, as you're composing a piece, what goes through your head?
Sure. Moonshine specifically was inspired by two main ideas that I stuck together in a way. The piece is kind of disjointed because it has this like percussive element, but also like this kind of melodic jazz inspired idea, both of which are like really, really influenced by a German fingerstyle guitar player called Sörenke Meinen. Really, really inspirational guy. I actually met him the first time I went to the Thomas Lieb Acoustic Bootcamp. Sörenke is super inspiring for me because he has classical training and is also a fingerstyle guitar player, which is akin to the background that I come from. And so his piece, Fake Forgery, kind of inspired that idea of like incorporating this very hyped up drumming idea. As far as like the more melodic segment goes, that was actually something I came up with while thinking about this course that I was taking at the time called American Literature of the Jazz Age. The piece is called Moonshine because it's inspired by this like feeling of rebellion and of like creating systems outside of what is normal and what is accepted. That was an idea that really captured my imagination when I took that course. My audition was actually far more than that piece. I think I submitted 5 pieces in my audition. I really have to highlight Darren Au here. He's the head of the guitar department at Punahou. Like, I'm here at Harvard, not exactly a place that's like short in resources, but the one thing that I think Punahou is better than Harvard at is classical guitar. And I think that's all Darren. It's all him. Just to illustrate, he would like meet with me during his lunch breaks or after school and like set up a camera and a microphone in his classroom such that like I could have a space to record these pieces. And they were 5 of them. We did this a lot. And we'd take 4 takes of each, usually not more than that. And Darren really acted as a kind of producer for me. There were definitely moments where he'd be like, okay, I'm noticing that your posture is like this or that you're breathing in this particular way. Tell me about that, or you should fix this or have this mindset instead. So it's a much more emotionally intense process than I think the regular perception of it is, in addition to just being really long.
And so you sent that in. And then what was the timeline? What kinds of feedback did you get from the producers at From the Top?
So there was no second round of auditions, actually, just because like there is so much material that is submitted. So in addition to the 5 pieces that I submitted, there were also videos and essays relating to different topics about musicianship and about like my experiences as a performer and whatnot, basically trying to gauge, like, is there an interesting story here? And so I recorded those videos and sent them in sometime over last summer, so like June, July time. And I got the notification in October that I was a finalist and that they were trying to slot me into a cohort to find me a show. And October was actually a really, really convenient time for that to happen because I had to submit my college applications on November 1st. So really good timing on From the Top's part there.
What does that kind of recognition feel like to you, even as a pretty accomplished performer, I would say, but just getting the chance to have that kind of radio audience hear your work?
Oh, it's terrifying. Like, I did an interview for From the Top also, and I was like sitting in this studio and there's like 10 people on the other side of this window and like multiple producers and multiple sound crew. And I played fine because I know the piece super well and I wrote it. But like once you get to the talking portion, like I just completely froze up. I was thinking like, oh my God, the number of people that are going to hear this is more than I could ever like functionally perceive in my entire lifetime. And it's scary. And like, I did freeze up quite a bit in that interview because of that. But I also think just like as an opportunity, I'm really excited about being able to bring percussive fingerstyle and this like very niche community of music. And also just like, you know, the people that have supported me, like someone like Darren, just to like talk about them to so many people and talk about how great they are and talk about how great this style is. I'm excited about the opportunity to like be able to spread that and be able to basically have a reason for a wider audience to listen to us.
You shared that you're studying electrical engineering, which seems pretty different from professional guitar, but what role do you see music playing in your life as you're in college and then eventually beyond?
I mean, for me, I don't intend to be a musician professionally in any way, shape, or form. I started down that path a little bit when I was in high school, and it just became very obvious to me that it would suck all the joy out of it. I think there's definitely a type of person that can do that. I just don't think that's me. But for me, I view music mostly as a way to connect with people. I mean, even just in the past couple of weeks here at Harvard, like there was a first year talent show that I auditioned for, and like spending like 2 hours in the green room with all of these people, like after this interview, I'm going to go have dinner with all of them because we got so close there. Finding opportunities to collaborate and to connect with people and to just have serendipitous experiences, like that is what music is a vehicle for me right now.
Thank you so much, Ashbu, for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Maddie. Glad to be here.
That was HPR's Maddie Bender and Ashbu, a Punahou graduate who was featured today on the nationally syndicated classic radio program From the Top. We'll have a link on our website where you can listen to the full segment featuring Boo and her piece, Moonshine. And now we'll play you out with Newton, another one of her original compositions.
Okay. So this piece is called Newton. It was inspired by an experience that I had in physics class last year and the community that I found through that. It is about the joy of discovery and about the frustration and about the pushing through.
Well, that's it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to hear from the author of an acclaimed book about the final voyage of Captain James Cook. Is it time to reassess Captain Cook's legacy? Give us some feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Did you know you can find the conversation as a podcast? You can head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.